Welcome to the Adoptee Thoughts podcast. I am your host, Melissa Guida Richards, an adoption educator, adoptee, and author of What White Parents Should Know About Transracial Adoption and its follow-up workbook. This season, I will be highlighting adoption changemakers who are in the trenches of the adoption and foster care community, championing the best interests of children. These individuals will range from adoptees and former foster youth, to researchers, adoptive and foster parents, to child welfare workers, and many more. Like always, we will delve into the nuances of adoption, and most importantly, we will not shy away from the tough topics. Today, I have the pleasure of sharing a wonderful conversation with Gretchen Sisson, PhD, who is a sociologist and author of the new release, Relinquished: Politics of Adoption and the Privilege of American Motherhood. Her studies on adoption include hundreds of in-depth interviews with women who have relinquished infants for domestic adoption over the past 60 years, with a particular focus on women who have relinquished since Roe v. Wade. So thanks for joining me today, and let's jump into highlighting one of my favorite adoption changemakers.
I actually wanted to start off by asking you, because people will want to know, why adoption? What got you interested in this topic? You are a mother, right?
Yes.
How did you get involved?
Yeah, I started this project before I had a kid. This is my oldest baby in a way, right? I've been working on this data collection for 14 years. So I've had all of my kids since I started doing this data collection. But I'm not an adoptee. I'm not an adoptive parent. I'm not a birth mother. So why am I doing this project? I started doing this project back when I was in graduate school. I didn't know I was writing a book at the time. I wasn't writing a book at the time when I started doing the data collection, right? I was a 25-year-old grad student living in Boston. I was working at an organization called the Alliance on Teen Pregnancy at the time. And we did some work on pregnancy prevention, but most of our work was really on supporting young families and helping them lobby for better pregnant and parenting student policies in the Boston City Schools, better access to housing and childcare for these young families, right? And I was really inspired by these young mothers that I was working with. And the gap between what is actually true about teen pregnancy in young families and the sort of social myths that we have about how inevitably devastating young parenthood is for them and their children, the social science evidence just does not back that up, right? And so this was my first time sort of being in a space where the gap between the research and the lived experience and the cultural conversation, which is wildly at odds. And Anne Fessler's Girls Who Went Away had come out a couple years earlier. I had read that. Juno had come out a couple years earlier. Obviously saw that. And then 16 and Pregnant started airing on MTV. And in the first season, they had Caitlin and Tyler, and really framing Caitlin and Tyler in contrast. Caitlin and Tyler, for those who aren't obsessed with, you know, 14-year-old pop culture, Caitlin and Tyler were this couple who had relinquished their daughter for adoption. All the other mothers and couples that were featured on the show were parenting. And Caitlin and Tyler were sort of framed as better parents, right? They were more mature. They were more reasonable. They were more self-sacrificing. They were doing a better job of setting up a future for their child compared to the young families that wanted to parent. And I'm looking at these other family, these young women that I'm working with who are fighting so hard for what they need to support themselves and their kids, and who I find really inspiring. And it just sort of brought up this gap again in how we understand what it actually means to support families, who need support, what that looks like. And again, the breakdown between what actual lived experiences are and what our cultural conversation is. So that's how I started looking at adoption. Would not have guessed at the time that this is where we would be, you know, 14 years later. But I also wanted to do follow-up over time to see how people's feelings about their adoptions changed. And so it became a lot longer and bigger of a project, but I'm really excited to have it out soon.
Yeah, I was rereading some of my notes that I had in the galley, and I really like how you were talking about the POV of how people view adoption and how that has been shaped by American media, like 16 and Pregnant. And I remember being a teenager and watching 16 and Pregnant and being like, oh, how are these kids having kids? And it was, like you said, that thought process of Tyler and what was Caitlin. Caitlin, they were seen as more mature. And even to this day, I get questions about how do I view like that adoption situation now that we see the grief that Caitlin is going through from being separated from her child. And like, that wasn't really talked about at all. What was it, 10-ish years ago? Then with Juno too. Misconceptions about adoption are really taken by like how the media portrays it. And I feel like people don't understand how powerful of a role the media portrays it.
Right. And I think particularly, like I'll do some interviews and reports like, well, I don't know any birth mothers. You don't know, you know any birth mothers, right? But mm-hmm. you might. And what's been interesting to me is as I've done this work, as I've been more public about doing this work, people come to me like, oh, I'm a birth mother. And this is a friend I had from college, right? She's like, oh yeah, I relinquished my son before I started college. Or my friend who's like, yeah, my older sister relinquished a baby back in the early 80s. Ruined her life, right? And, you know, I think that, you know, these stories are hidden in many ways, but they're also erased in a lot of ways. We don't give space, and they're also silenced. We don't give a lot of space for them. And I will say, you know, I know a lot of birth parents at this point through my work, through my research. You know, I'm doing another radio interview next week, and someone was like, would any of your participants like to join you? And I'm like, look, I don't know. The condition of anonymity for them was so strong that that was the only way they were going to share their story, because they don't want to alienate their child's adoptive parents. A lot of people in their lives might not know about the adoption or the circumstances under which it occurred. It is hard to find people to talk about this in a way that feels comfortable for them. And, you know, I fully respect that, you know, but I think that is, these stories are often missing. And I think that we also forget that, you know, there's a privilege, there's an inherent privilege dynamic when you're talking about adoption, which is that adoptive families almost always have more resources, more ability to get their stories out in the world than families of origin do. And so you see a lot of policymakers, a lot of screenwriters, you know, public advocates that are able to have a really big platform as adoptive parents and to tell stories about adoption as a way of family building, because those are the types of stories that we so often see. It's far rarer that we see stories of adoption that are actually about family separation, even though mm-hmm. every adoption is both.
Yeah. And stigma is so heavy. Like, I was adopted internationally, so your book focuses more on American adoptions. But even distance between my adoptive family versus my first family, the stigma is so heavy, even across like oceans here. And that was one of the initial reasons why it was so hard for my birth mother to kind of be open to a relationship, worry about how her family, after, you know, she had gotten married, she had more kids. And people don't realize that adoption doesn't just affect you at that moment in time where that initial relinquishment happens. This is long-lasting effect from one choice that was made because of circumstances that affects not just one person or two people. These are affecting generations of family members. And I have that, I've been talking about adoption so publicly for the past few years. I have now like children of adoptees reaching out to me and looking for resources. And there's such a gap here because we are just now beginning to understand like all the effects that it has. That initial stigma that we think of just, you know, affecting birth mothers. People think like grief of placing a child, that's normal. They don't realize like that is going to affect future generations of children that person has. And, you know, like it's not just like little moment.
Right. And I think that was why I wanted to do 10-year follow-up data collection. Because the question, when I first started doing interviews, and what I found was mothers who had been in adoptions longer, their adoptions were older, they were in a more critical space. But there were some mothers that I spoke with who were maybe 2-3 years out that were feeling really optimistic and really positive about their adoptions. Kind of in that 1-2 year period, there's so much grief and mourning that overwhelms everything else. But then you have this window, this kind of like honeymoon period where they're like feeling good, right? And what I wanted to know is if mothers and older adoptions are more critical and mothers and more recent adoptions seem to have more hope that the system is going to work out for them, is that because adoption has gotten better over time, right? Are we on a historical trajectory by which adoption is getting better? Or does everyone kind of become more critical after more time passes? And I had to interview that same group of women again in 2020 to find out. And what I found out was it was the latter, right? That they were almost all in a far more critical space. So there was one woman I interviewed in 2010. Her son was, it was just a little bit past her son's first birthday. She was feeling great, right? She had a great open adoption. She had actually breastfed and pumped for a long time, and her son's adoptive parents were local. They would come, right? Like, she was seeing him regularly. She went to his baptism, you know, and she was feeling great about the parents that she had chosen, what her son's life was going to look like, what it allowed her. And then when I spoke with, I asked her, I was like, what should adoption look like? She's like, every adoption should look like mine, right? She was in this like, real honeymoon space. And I don't want to discount that, right? I had talked to her that one time, I would have been like, maybe adoption is awesome sometimes, you know? When I talked with her 10 years later, she was like, this adoption should never have happened, right? She's like, I was dealing with a lot of trauma. I was dealing with problematic ideas about what families needed to be. The amount of contact she had with her child wasn't quite what she wanted. She was seeing him struggle with some aspects of having been adopted in ways that she couldn't necessarily support. It's neurodivergencies that she felt his adoptive parents weren't really handling well, help, you know, supporting him in, whereas she had been at this point and her husband had some neurodivergencies as well. She thought he would have been a great stepfather for her child, right? And so she said, I made this decision as a 19-year-old because she grew up in the evangelical church and she so deeply believed that a child needed to have two married parents. That was the only way that a child could have a good upbringing. She herself was raised by a single mom. She had complicated feelings about that. She thought this she was setting her kid up for success by placing him with this married couple. You know, within 4 years, she was married, right? She had that stable home. And she acknowledged, I don't know what my life would have looked like if I had parented. Would I have married this person? You know, what else would have needed to happen? So mothers are very keen to understand that the life that they have now is also shaped by the adoption, right? And they're not naive in understanding that. But they also recognize that the circumstances under which they made a permanent lifelong decision have shifted. And so I think that, you know, that was why, again, it was so important for me to follow, because these are lifelong decisions. Because if we're going to look at how adoption serves people, we can't just look at a single moment. We need to look at how they'd understand these things over time.
Yeah, definitely. And I really appreciated you going into like this honeymoon period. I think a lot of adoptees generally start referring to themselves coming out of the fog. So it was interesting to see how it was framed for birth parents, because, you know, there's a lot of similarities where adoptees and birth parents are kind of like opening their eyes to this new reality of what adoption is. And like we said earlier, it's often shaped by what we were taught to believe it is versus our actual lived experience. And that really differs. Well, like your research shows that from the beginning of an adoption versus years down the line. And I think a lot of people have this idea that like, if you choose an open adoption, it's open forever. And unfortunately, the reality is that a lot of open adoptions end up closing in the first few years. And that extent of how much it is open is dependent upon the adoptive parents. That power automatically like goes to them, and everybody else is kind of, you know, it's left up to chance.
Yeah. And I think some of the mothers, almost all of the mothers that I spoke with were in what they would call an open adoption, right? That's what the agency told them that they were having, right? And they were, but for some, that was getting pictures through the agency a couple times a year. They didn't know what city their child lived in. They didn't know their child's last name. They had no direct way of contacting them, right? But that was still considered an open adoption because they picked the parents. They got occasional pictures, maybe for the first 3 years or whatever. On the other end of the spectrum were mothers who were babysitting their own kids, going on family vacation with the adoptive parents, right? So you know, picking up kids from school, going to soccer games and ballet recitals, right? Like you had the full gamut and then kind of everything in between. All of the mothers that I spoke with wanted to have some contact with their child. Not all of them said that they wanted that at the beginning. So there were, usually that was a question of safety, right? There was one mother in particular who said, I wanted a close adoption. I was in an extremely abusive relationship. I did not want this child to ever have contact with their birth father because it would not be safe for them, right? But even then, they kept the door cracked open so that she could have some information. And then once she was able to safely leave that relationship, they were able to have more contact, right? And then she actually ended up relinquishing a second child, and they couldn't go to the same family, but they were adopted by a family in the same town. And so the children and their adoptive parents are very close and they have an open adoption together, right? That was such an extreme circumstance. And it was the only one where a mother was like, I need this to be closed now. She didn't want it to be closed, right? She wanted to have contact with her child, but for safety's sake, she felt that it needed to be more closed. Adoptive parents often ask me like, well, your sample must be biased because my child's birth mom doesn't want to have contact with us or doesn't respond to our outreach. And what I always say is we think of openness as a favor for birth parents, right? The person that actually benefits the most from openness is the adoptee, right? A lot of the mothers I spoke with, ones who desperately wanted to have more contact with their child, it was still very painful, right? One mother I spoke with said she has one Sunday a week where she gets to, her child was a little older, I think 12 or so. She would pick him up. They'd spend the whole day together. She needed to take the next day off of work every day, because she would become so depressed after saying goodbye to him, right? She wants that contact. She believes it's good for him. She wants to be available. She relishes their time together, but it is so hard. The trauma of the adoption makes it hard to maintain that connection. Or, you know, another mother that I spoke with, this is in our first interview. So her son was, I think, 5 or 6. She had a 3-year-old that she was parenting. She was pregnant again at the time of our interview. So she's, you know, married and co-parenting with her husband, obviously, for her 2 younger children. She would meet up once a year with her relinquished son and his adoptive mother. They had a tradition of going to McDonald's and they would get a happy meal and he would play on the play structure. So this is an open adoption because she's seeing him. Mm-hmm. He doesn't know that this is his birth mother. Right. So the adoptive parents haven't said this woman is your mother. Right. So from her point of view, she wants this to be open because she wants her son to know her. Right. She's like, everything I'm getting out of those visits, I could get from pictures or videos, phone calls. Right. He's not getting the benefit. Like, this is painful to me. I'm going through it because I want it to benefit him. So she ended up cutting off contact because she said, this isn't benefiting him and it's too hard for me. And then she's also worried about her 3. She's like, I've been clear with my 3-year-old who she was parenting. This is your brother, right? And she's like, and my 3-year-old's going to like spill the beans at some point if I keep bringing her around, right? Because she wanted them to have an open sibling relationship. And that clearly was not happening. So I think when we talk about openness, it can look like any number of things, right? And some of them are going to be purportedly about serving the birth parents' needs, purportedly about serving the adoptees' needs, but not always easy enough or worth it enough that the mother feels like this is something that she can always continue for her own emotional and psychological well-being. I did see some of the mothers that I spoke with pulling back at different points if they felt like the openness wasn't worth it for their child or was too painful for them.
And I think that goes into this black and white thinking when it comes to adoption. From the surface, if you just hear that, oh, the birth mother isn't responding to my texts and my calls, you know, I'm trying, I'm making this effort, but you're not really looking at the 72 other possible reasons that are affecting that one decision. Just posts I've seen and like adoptive parent groups and just consultations that I've done with adoptive parents, it's oftentimes just seen as self-centered almost, because it's just like, well, I keep doing this. And then it's like, well, it's taking a lot on my part to keep sending pictures. And I don't know how that's going to affect my child and X, Y, and Z. And then excuses are quickly made as to why they can't possibly keep the adoption open. It's just, it goes into that narrative once again that adoptees are told that we're unwanted. And we see that she's like, well, you know, I tried to keep this adoption open for you, but they don't want contact with you. What am I supposed to do? You know, that abandonment is reinforced.
I
mean,
I will say, because I view openness as primarily helpful, beneficial, protective for the adopted person, I do think that birth mothers should feel some obligation to maintain contact as much as possible, right? But I also think that birth parents aren't taught how important adoption or how important openness is for their adopted child, right? Mm-hmm. That they, if they have been told this idea that openness is for birth parents and they're like, well, this is painful, so I'm out, right? Like, a lot of them hadn't been taught how important that was for their child, right? So that's also part of the problem. And adoptive parents aren't as flexible, loving, persistent, forgiving in their outreach because they're like, oh, well, this is primarily for you. So if you don't want to be part of our kids' life, like, you're lost, right? So if we need to come, a lot of the mothers I spoke with did understand this, right? They're like, this sucks dealing with these visits because it's hard to be around my child. I will do it for that. Like, a lot of them got it, right? And when I say it sucks, that's a little flippant and I apologize, right? It wasn't that they wanted to have contact with their child. They enjoyed the time with their child, but it was hard to then re-separate from them. That's what sucked for them. But I think that if we reorientate the idea of openness for the benefit of the child, then both sets of parents might be more committed to making it work rather than when we understand openness as primarily for the birth parent.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent point. And then that kind of goes into where in your book, you mentioned that at some point, like early on, birth mothers don't understand or don't know that there are some risks that adopted people face, like post-adoption. We are often taught that adoption is supposed to be this happily ever after solution. So the child is adopted into a loving two-parent household, and often cases that are upper middle class, typically white. And, you know, that's supposed to be the happily ever after where, you know, that's it. Keep that openness for the birth parent because that benefits them. But we're not talking about how that affects the child further on down the road. Can you add a little bit more to that?
Yeah, so very few mothers that I interviewed were offered meaningful options counseling. And there, that included for a lot of them, like, they didn't have any information around what adoption means for adopted people, right? Other than this is going to be so beautiful. Look at this family you're going to be able to give them. You know, look at these beautiful pictures in their profile, and they have, you know, and the profiles really so directly speak to the vulnerabilities of expectant mothers who are considering adoption, right? To an extreme degree, like, so many of them become really starstruck by the prospective adoptive parents. So if you're looking at a pregnant person who, you know, doesn't have stable housing, her own parents aren't supporting, her boyfriend isn't showing up the way she wants him to, she's struggling to finish school, or she hasn't been able to finish school, she had, you know, for whatever reason, that's sort of where she is. And you're looking at these profiles of like, here's our gorgeous suburban house, here's our Sunday dinners with cousins and our parents who can't wait to be grandparents, and here's pictures from our wedding 10 years ago, right? Like, they really are designed to showcase all of the elements that speak to what birth mothers are missing in their lives that make them vulnerable to considering adoption. So I think that that's one piece of it, is that this becomes almost like an infatuation really early on. And birth mothers aren't given counseling around what would parenthood look like. Very few of them sat down with someone who's like, let's talk about what parenting might look like for you. Is this possible? What would this look like? What kind of support would you need? And most of them wanted to parent, but they never had anyone who said, let's figure out what that might look like for you. You can do this if you want to. It's going to be tough. Let's figure it out, right? It was like, adoption is going to offer more for your child, a better life. And so often a better life, of course, is tied to financial resources. And I think that that's really important. So they had very little counseling, and most of the counseling was really adoption promotion, because at that point, they're really already interacting closely with agencies. So we did not see a lot of people thinking about talking to them about what other pathways might be available to them. And a lot of mothers that I spoke with who came to a much more deeply critical space after time was because they had learned a lot more about adoption and what adoption means for adopted people. And a lot of them, that learning journey was sparked by seeing their child struggle in some ways, right?
Hi, friends. I'm doing a giveaway of Relinquished, Gretchen's book. All you have to do to enter is subscribe to my channel on YouTube at adoptee_thoughts. Leave a comment saying one of the things that you enjoyed about the interview. And for additional entries, tag some of your friends in the comments. Each comment tagging a friend is another entry. And at the end of 10 days, once this is published and live, I will announce the winner. Thanks, guys.
This was even particularly true, and I talk about in the book, white mothers of biracial children rarely considered their child would be in a transracial adoption if they chose white parents for them. Mm-hmm. Mothers of color, like, thought a huge amount about the race of the adoptive parents. They could rarely get what they wanted for their child in that way, but they thought about it a lot. White mothers barely thought about it at all, right? And I think that that is another big problem. And then a lot of them saw, like, I have this biracial Black child. He does not have a connection to his birth father's family. He has a connection to me as his birth mother, but I'm white. His adoptive parents are white. The community he's growing up in is white, right? And they saw the struggles that were coming from that for their child of not having anyone who looked like them in their families and their communities. So I think that that was really important as well. And a lot of mothers, again, over time, they saw their child having challenges around the adoption. They saw themselves having, and that was really what made them want to learn more deeply and then feel a lot more critically about what had been told to them when they were pregnant.
It's really interesting, too. As a transracial adoptee, when I talk about the struggles that I face as a woman of color who was raised in a white adoptive family who had a lot of prejudices, people try to say, color doesn't matter. You're making race a thing when it's not. When at the very beginning, like adoption practices, it's mentioned in your book about a lot of mothers that were pressured and forced into giving up their children for adoption. It started with slavery. And, you know, these things happened with like indigenous people. We had, you know, the Indian Child Welfare Act that had to be enacted and then again being fought to be taken down, you know, recently, because people often are so used to being a global majority and like being the default that they don't think about how race affects other people in their day-to-day lives. And when it comes to adoption, it's such an integral piece that factors in how children are being raised. And if we're saying, you know, race isn't a problem, and you mentioned the Republicans versus liberals and how they view adoption, and like liberals are like, you know, love makes a family, let's not think about anything else. And then the Republicans are like, well, you know, a heteronormative family structure with two parents, a male and a female, and then they're married, like that is the ideal structure. So we're having all these different arguments about like what makes the best family or the healthiest family. But then at the root of it, we are forgetting these huge other factors that go into raising children in these transracially adopted families. And if we don't talk about race, we're ignoring the struggles that transracial adoptees like me go through. And then what are we doing? We're just pushing it to the side because these adoption agencies are just trying to get more families to place children. And you go into how the number of waiting families versus the number of infants available is such like a staggering difference. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
So, and you mentioned like a couple of these historical examples that I include of family separation. And I think it's important to understand there are a lot of reasons that families have been separated over American history. Almost none of them are good. None of them are good. Let's just say that, you know, because all of them have been so deeply abusive. There is a pattern by which children are separated from their families in order to police those families, to threaten families, to extract obedience from parents, and to leave that threat of family separation in order to get populations to behave and to, you know, not challenge a white supremacist system. Those are almost always families of color. Historically, almost always Black families. Or Native families with this history of boarding school separations, the Indian Adoption Project, that sort of thing. So there's that policing element that leads to family separation. There's also the market forces that shape adoption. And these are more historically recent, right? The idea that it used to be, if you look more than 100 years ago, you had babies who there wasn't a demand for, right? So if you were a poor family and you had more children than you could care for, you had to go pay a baby farmer like to provide sort of like base level care for your child. There was no one who's going to pay you to adopt that child, right? But there was this early shift in the early 19th century that sort of placed a market value on children, that really commodified children. But it was actually a commodification of parenthood, right? Because children were no longer economically beneficial, right? Like, I don't have kids anymore because I need more people to help work on my farm, right? I don't have. There's no economic benefit to me having kids. I have children because I have a value on being a mother. Right. And that shift, Viviana Zelzer is a sociologist who has studied that and looked at that kind of historical change. And ever since that shift, where parenthood has been a desirable commodity, children have been a desirable commodity. And that's when you see the evolution of a market-based adoption system that involves the permanent legal transfer of parental rights. So you have these two sorts of historical forces. One is this policing force that leads to family separation. One is a market force that incentivizes family separation. And these have operated in like parallel tracks for a while, right? And it's why you have a child welfare system that disproportionately impacts Black and Brown families, and why historically you had a private adoption system that put a market demand on white babies that we saw in the baby scoop era, right? That's why that was so predominantly white women. What we're seeing now actually is kind of these systems converging, right? For a number of reasons. And not completely, like I don't want to They're not, but they're much closer tracks than they used to be. A couple of things are going on there. We have abortion access. We did have abortion access pretty robustly for 50 years. We have it in a piecemeal way now. So when you look at a lot of the women that were targeted for adoption pre-Roe, unplanned pregnancy delivery weight plummets pretty quickly. So there's fewer white babies available. Fewer white babies available. We pass the Indian Child Welfare Act, fewer Native babies available. And you couldn't at that time introduce Black children into a private system. There still wasn't a market demand. That's when you start to see the uptick of international adoption, right? And that's when you start to see a lot more children from South and Central America, and then Russia, and then finally Africa, sort of like in China. And when we look at the countries that are exporting their children, it was countries that are economically and geopolitically stable, like don't export their. Sorry, I also should say Korea. I'm not trying to erase anyone, I promise. International adoption is not my expertise. But you have this wave of international adoptees that are coming into the United States throughout the 90s to 2004, and then it really starts dropping pretty precipitously. So what you're constantly having is this sense of there's a demand for babies. Where are they going to come from, right? In the 60s and 70s, we're going to extract them from, you know, vulnerable white women that we can police because they don't have access to abortion. Then that falls. Then you see the increase in international adoption. International adoption also made Americans far more comfortable with transracial adoption, right? Because mm-hmm. they weren't ready to adopt Black children quite yet. Eventually they do from Africa, from Haiti, right? But it started with when Asian American children and South and Central American children. And Elizabeth Rollins has an excellent book. I'm looking over here because it's right over here. Selling Transracial Adoption on this impact of how now we're at this point where the demand for babies is so absolute. We have created a market demand for any healthy babies of any race. It's not an even market, right? But it is there, right? White families are perfectly willing to adopt Black children. So most of them. So you have this sort of convergence, and at the same time, you have adoption becoming increasingly about economic deprivation, poverty, inequality, right? So you have more and more mothers that are relinquishing because they cannot afford another child, right? So you, again, you look back 30, 40 years, mothers were relinquishing children because they wanted to delay parenthood, right? They weren't married. Now wasn't the appropriate time for them to parent. And so they're going to relinquish their firstborn child until they are in a more stable or appropriate parenting life space. What you're seeing now is a majority of birth mothers are relinquishing second, third, fourth, or more children. And it is because they want to parent, but they're at the tipping point for what their family can support and afford. And you're increasingly seeing more participation from mothers of color, I think largely for that reason. You're also seeing the ways that the public adoption system, foster care, which is more about policing, sort of that historic trend, drawing on the private adoption system and vice versa. So a lot of mothers I spoke with, if they had lost earlier children, older children to foster care, they were pregnant again, the private agency would say, well, look, you have older kids in foster care, you're probably going to lose custody of this baby. But if you do a private adoption, then you can choose the parents, you can have an open adoption, right? You're going to have more power over this situation. It's not a foregone conclusion that they're going to lose custody of another baby, right? But you see the ways that these systems are increasingly tangled with one another. That was an incredibly long answer. I hope that sort of...
No, it's great. No, I think a lot of people don't realize how entrenched everything is. Before I forget, because we were talking about like race and adoption in America, did you ever in your studies talk about or research any of the American mothers that place children for adoption out of America into other countries?
No. So all of the mothers that I interviewed were American women who were relinquishing within the United States. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I just wanted to just touch upon that because like a lot of people don't, you know, there are a number of mothers that choose to place their children into a country outside of America. And those tend to be Black mothers too.
Yeah. Well, so Melissa, I mean, you might know more about this than me. That was the impression that I have too, is that those are mostly Black mothers and agencies cannot find Black adoptive families for them. So they look outside of the United States. That was the impression that I have too, is that those are mostly Black mothers and agencies cannot find Black adoptive families for them. So they look outside of the United States. And that was true. Like a number of mothers that I interviewed, they're like, I'm a Black woman. My child's going to be Black. I am only going to place them with Black parents. And then the agencies are like, we don't have any Black parents. And they're like, okay, well, I'm not going to place. And then the pregnancy goes on and circumstances don't change and agencies can't find, you know, and then they're like, okay, well, I guess I'll give them to these white parents who already have a Black child. So at least they're not the only Black, like they make these sort of concessions. Or, you know, there was one white mother, but her child was biracial and she wanted him to have biracial parents. She was the kind of the rare white mother who was really thinking closely about what her child's experience would be as a transracial adoptee, couldn't find biracial or, you know, interracial couple to adopt. And so she's like, well, I'm going to place him with this couple who lives in Manhattan, right? So at least he'll be around a lot of different people, like he's not going to be in an all white community, you know, in a different part of the country, right? So you had mothers kind of making concessions, making compromises. It has been my, and again, you might know more about this than I do. It has been my impression that American women who relinquish for international adoption outside of the US, it's usually because they are looking for families that American agencies cannot provide them.
I think in my research, it also showed because of how racialized America is, people can view some other countries like Italy and Canada and other places that adopt from America as least being less of an issue. And I've talked to international adoptees from other sides of the world too. Race is an issue everywhere. So it was just, you know, I wanted to see if any participants that you talked to had any interaction with that. When it comes to the sample size of the women and pregnant parents that you talked to, how did you collect all these people for your study?
I found people in a lot of different ways, and I found them in very different ways in 2010 than I did in 2020. And I should say, I did a lot more interviews than are included in the sample in the book, because I interviewed a lot of mothers that relinquished in the 80s, 90s, earlier than that. But I wanted the sample in the book to be really contained to adoptions between 2000 and 2020. The sample has shifted, right? If you look at some of my earlier research papers, like it has kind of these older adoptions. So the book is really, again, 2000 to 2020. In 2010, when I did my first recruitment, I sort of did initial recruitment, online ads and support groups, online support groups, blogs, et cetera. But I will also say one of the biggest boons or fortuitous things that happened in 2010 was that so many adoption agencies still had message boards at the time for their birth mothers. And I would interview one or two birth mothers and they would post them on their agency's message boards, right? And this is actually excellent because if I'm recruiting people only from support groups, like they're already in a really critical space. But the message boards were just for people who were at all stages of their adoption journey through this agency. And they were still relying on agency mediated spaces to make those connections happen. So a lot of times I would ask them to be like, if you know anyone else, if you're on a message board, if you're in a closed group, please share the call. And that's how I got a lot of participants. Because a lot of those spaces are closed to people who aren't birth mothers. You know, I don't want to insert myself there directly. But once I had spoken with a few, I got a lot more. And then the message boards all shut down. They shut down in 2012, 13, 14. They are kind of a thing of the past. But I had already had contacts with these women. And so I was able to follow them over time once they were already in the sample. In 2020, I did additional recruitment. That was a lot easier because it's so much easier to do targeted online marketing. I knew so many more birth mothers to start for them to send mothers to me. I did outreach through some agencies, which is interesting because I don't want to just be recruiting from spaces that are adoption critical spaces. I want to be recruiting different points and how they're understanding their adoption and then are finding me in different ways. So it was a lot. It was a lot of different outreach in a lot of different ways. And I think that the sample is good, right? It was very white in 2010, the initial recruitment. That's what adoption looks like. In the last 20 years, certainly in the last 10 years, we see far more women of color participating in the private adoption system. Obviously, would have loved to include more voices of color in the earlier sample, but I don't think that the whiteness of my earliest sample is that much of an outlier. Right. I think that that is sort of where private adoption was and had been. And I think that the diversity of my 2020 sample is reflective, not just of better recruitment, but of a real shift in who's participating in the system.
And I think that goes into the demand of adoption because people don't see it as like business that it is, like multi-billion dollar business, especially like private agencies. I feel like a lot of agencies back in the early 2000s and even before that, it was what families wanted. And people don't see it as children being commodified based on race. There is still to this day race-based pricing of children. And we have headlines that say Black babies cost less. We have people labeling children in adoption agencies as multiracial to make them more marketable for the families looking to adopt because of their proximity to whiteness. If they have a closer proximity to whiteness, then the agencies can charge more, then they can make more money. And it's just a cycle that keeps going and going. And I don't think people are very aware of how it is a market. And I also really liked how you talked about how adoption is marketed. And there was one point where you were talking about, you got an email. What was it from?
Oh, yeah. It was an advertising agency. Look, I don't know why I get these emails. The things people email me, Melissa, I mean, and you know, but I have to believe it's because people who work in the adoption space believe that what they are doing is deeply good, right? They believe that it's a social good. And so if you ask them for something, they will often just send it to you because they don't think what they're doing is a problem, right? Like I have data on thousands and thousands of adoptions that agencies have just sent me because I asked for it, right? Like, you know what I mean? People are like, how did you get data on 8,000 adoptions? I was like, oh, I asked agencies. Like, there's a couple really big agencies and they'll just send it to you, right? Because they believe in what they're doing. You know, why would they not share it? So that's a side note. But yes, I did get an email from an advertising firm that at the time they were geofencing Planned Parenthood's and other abortion clinics on behalf of Bethany Christian Services. And they're like, they tell me this straight up, right? So that if you took your phone, you have your phone, you go to Planned Parenthood, you go to an abortion clinic, you'll start getting ads for adoption agencies. They did this. You know, and it said at the line of the email, like, if you're not the appropriate person, you know, to receive this, like, please forward it. And I was like, I'm not the appropriate person to forward this. But they also geofence like methadone clinics. There have been other cases where they were geofencing like WIC sites, Medicaid, healthcare sites, you know, because they're really targeting low income pregnant people. Agencies will also buy strings. Like you can look in online advertising databases to see who's buying certain Google words, and they'll buy strings on like help for single moms, California. You'll start getting ads for adoption agencies. You know, they're really aggressive in targeting these groups. Texas is actually just establishing a new modern adoption campaign that's specifically targeting Black and Latino women in Texas that they're pushing really heavily. They're putting millions of dollars into that. You know, and it's because this is a problem. This is a solution in search of a problem, right? Like this is, we believe adoption is good. We need to promote adoption. Whereas if you just spent the same amount of resources on supporting families, you wouldn't need to have adoptions. But we believe adoption is a good thing. We believe that a low adoption rate is a bad thing, right? I participated, again, why I got invited to this meeting, I'm not sure. But in 2020, I was invited to this meeting from the Department of Health and Human Services,
yes.
Which I talk about in the book. And the premise of the meeting was our domestic adoption rate is really low. What are we going to do about it? And I'm like, so why is it low? Right? Is it just low because people are parenting their children? Because then what's the problem? Right? Like, you know, and research has consistently shown, even in super adoption promotion spaces, anti-abortion spaces, and they're kind of, Venn diagram has a large overlap between those two kinds of spaces. You know, they acknowledge that knowledge of adoption is high, right? Consideration of adoption is high as far as on the part of adoptive parents. Like a lot of people consider adopting a child. Almost everyone knows adoption exists, right? So low adoption rates are not a reflection of people being like, what's adoption? I don't know what that is. But people do know. They have seen it. They have come across it, right? It's just that they are not interested in relinquishing their children if they have any other path. And so I find that this idea that we should be promoting adoption in response to anything, in response to a low adoption rate, in response to a high abortion rate, like none of these things are really related when we look at how pregnant people are making decisions. And if you don't see something intrinsically good with adoption, then it is totally fine if the rate is low. And I will say, as someone who's like in the abortion space, a lot, right? Like I'm at the OBGYN department here at UCSF. Like I come to these questions from like a reproductive health background, right? No one who works in the abortion space or does abortion research, no one's like, oh, the abortion rate is going down. That's a problem. Our question is it going down because fewer people need or want abortions, or is it going down because people can't get abortions that they want, right? If the abortion rate is really low, but everybody who wants to have an abortion is still getting one, totally fine, right? And what we don't ask this question around adoption, because we believe adoption is good. We believe more adoption is a good thing to have in a society. Whereas I see higher rates of adoption as a fundamental reflection of greater levels of inequity and lesser levels of support for families.
Yeah, it's interesting because like when the Supreme Court was going against like, you know, my mind's blanking, but in the abortion debate, we had people like referencing like the domestic supply of infants, and like right there, like that just shows like the domestic supply of infants. You're talking about human beings as they are, like a product on a shelf. And if we have like the U.S. Department of Human Services, where you were at that meeting, like developing strategies for overcoming barriers to private infant adoption. Like, why is that the focus here? To get more babies, to feed this demand for this business. And meanwhile, we know there are hundreds of thousands of children who are older children in foster care who are in need of homes, who cannot possibly be reunified with their biological families. But yet we're here trying to look for a problem and, you know, create advertising to target these families to get more kids. You know, it just,
I will also say when it comes to the foster care system, right, what we actually need are more people willing to serve. One, we need to think very critically about why children are in foster care in the first place. And I am very persuaded by a lot of the abolitionist arguments that take a deep look at the disparate impacts that these systems are having on punishing people and what that means. So tremendous, there should not be as many children available in foster care for a number of reasons. Yeah, but assuming that there are, what we actually need in our communities are not more adoptive parents, but more people who are willing to care for children in their communities without adoption, right? We have this idea that the only way to support families in need is by separating those families and legally establishing another one, right? That you have to have ownership over a child in order to care for a vulnerable child, right? And you see this with a lot of parents who are like, we're fostering, but to adopt, right? They're going to be heartbroken if that child reunifies at some point. That's actually what we need. And this is why people, you know, when I'm critical of adoption, which I always am at this point, you know, the idea is that, oh, that means you want children to be in unsafe homes. No, that is absolutely not what I want. I just think that the idea that we need to legally separate children from their families and move them to a different family is a very uncreative way of thinking about how we care for our vulnerable children, right? And I think that it does a great deal of harm that we have never acknowledged and are not willing to acknowledge, because we are still willing to commodify these children and offer them of value to families who want to adopt. And so I think that until we can sort of break that idea that the best way to care for children is through adoption, where this system is going to continue to be deeply flawed, entirely flawed.
And I think that studies and books like yours are so important, because there is that misconception where people are assuming that birth parents are placing their children because the alternative is unsafe living conditions, whether it's from abusive families, whether it's from drug and alcohol problems and other horrible and complicated systemic issues often. And they just see it as black and white. Well, if they didn't place, then the children would be suffering, or the children would be in garbage bins. That's what adoptees are told. You know, mm-hmm. If we speak out about the complications of an adoption, it's would you rather have been aborted? Would you rather have been a garbage can? Those aren't the only alternatives there.
And that's why I spoke with a birth mother once who was like, you know, my adoption wasn't about lack of money. I was just 16 years old and I didn't have a safe home to bring the baby to. And I was like, well, then we've already failed. If you at 16, was it a safe home for you to be in? And she's like, oh no, of course not. I was like, then we have already failed, right? We have failed. You as a 16-year-old are still so young. And I'm not, you know, if she's not in a safe home, of course she doesn't have a safe home for her child. We have already failed to account for those conditions, right? Or mothers who are, dealing with drug addiction and can't get access to treatment. And that's why they relinquish. Again, I don't, you know, I'm not naive. I know what it takes to raise children. I don't want people who are addicted to opioids raising children immediately either. I'm not saying that any person at any point in their life can raise every child. What I'm saying is, if we offer opportunities for housing, for treatment, for stability, people will take them to care for their children. Not in every case, right? I'm not looking at this with rose-colored glasses, but if we make it a little easier for a few numbers of people, the adoption rate is not high, right? We're not talking about millions and millions of families per year. We're talking about what it takes to care for the people we already have as parents, rather than just commodifying their children for other people. And I think that that is really, that to me is what it keeps coming back to.
Yeah, and if we think about like all the money that goes into like advertising to get more people to choose adoption, all the money from like tax breaks and all these things that go to adoptive families. And then we even have like in some families, in some cases, there are stipends that families will get until the child is 18, sometimes even a little bit longer. And like people don't realize that there are a lot of programs out there, but then, like you mentioned earlier, there are limitations when it comes to the birth parents and like access to things like WIC, and there's a stigma for like those programs and for like food stamps and for housing programs. We need to wrap up, but before we close, I wanted to ask, there was this one point in the book where you said that people often ask you, like, why aren't women who are denied abortion more interested in adoption? And I really loved your one of your responses to that, and where you basically said, like, well, why would you? Like, what would the situation be where you would place your child? And I feel like that's where people need to develop more empathy when it comes to adoption situations, and really put yourself in the shoes of a pregnant person in crisis. Because at the end of the day, what would make you comfortable carrying a child for 9 months, you know, going through 24 hours of labor, going through a C-section, possible pregnancy complications, you know, like all the things involved with motherhood. Like, what would make you comfortable to place? And that was just like such a profound like moment to me, and it made me curious, like how your thought process of adoption has developed from like the beginning of your research to now, and like what it took you to like get to this point where you can see this when you don't have any personal ties to adoption, if that makes sense.
You know, as I said, I have three children in between starting this data collection and writing this book. And so a lot of the mothers I interviewed had children same age as my kids when I did my final round of data collection, right? Kind of across the spectrum. And no mothers are relinquishing because they love their children less than I love my children, right? No one is relinquishing their child because they care less. They want less of the world for their child. Right. They're relinquishing because they have come to believe that their survival or their child's survival or their salvation depends on it. Right. Because one thing we haven't had a chance to talk about, and again, we could talk all day, but it are the religious constraints of how people understand what family, right? So you have to bring people to the point, to the brink, where they think the only way for them to survive, for their child to survive, to be safe, to thrive, is contingent on separating from them. Right. And I think that level of constraint is where we're really failing people. You know, you can increase, I can tell you how to increase the adoption rate. It's not pretty, right? If you push people to such a place of desperation, they'll relinquish, right? And that's why I chose the title Relinquish, because I think it reflects this surrender, right? It reflects not being in a position of power as you are making these choices. And I think that that is what we need to understand. We need to see each adoption as a failure to care for a family, right? And we need to stop seeing it as this beautiful family building institution. And we need to look at what that means, that what we as a society, as a country, allowed to occur, that separation felt like what was necessary for that mother.
Thank you. Is there anything else that you want to add before we end?
I don't think so. Well, I know I do have one thing, I guess, which is that people often ask me, like, why I don't talk more about adoptees in my work. And that is just a straightforward, I didn't study adoptees, right? I didn't study adoptee experiences. And that wasn't an omission, as more as like, this is where I'm going to focus, given my reproductive health background, given my reproductive justice work, this is where I'm going to be. You know, I have learned from and cited a ton of adoptee advocacy, organizing, scholarship, memoir in this book. I want the book to be very accountable to adopted people. And I know that, that's a lot of your audience, right? There's adopted people. And so I want to say that, right? This book isn't about adopted people. It's not trying to say that this is a comprehensive view of adoption in the United States. That's not possible without centering adoptees. But I do think that this is a missing part of the conversation so far. And that's what I have tried to do, is to bring the voices of birth mothers to this conversation. And I'm grateful for all the adoptees from whom I have learned, including you, from whom I have learned so much in the process of this research. And, you know, I hope to continue to be an ally in this work, to be in good conversation with this work. And by having my focus on birth parents, I am like, I hope you hear that I am not trying to say we don't also very critically need adoptee voices in this conversation.
No, I really appreciate you mentioning that. And I think it's important for listeners to hear that as well. And like one of the reasons why I like loved your book as an adoptee is because I feel like a lot of the information that I've learned about adoption and about birth mothers is a lot of like misconceptions, like you said, from the media, from, you know, like previous studies that adoption agencies put out that are very, you know, biased oftentimes. And so to have like a comprehensive book that lists like all of these women that have gone through these experiences helps adoptees understand how complicated the issue is as well, because it's often not broken down like this. We often don't have a comprehensive resource that lists all these things that have interviewed so many different women and pregnant people in crisis and, you know, give us this different perspective. So I think that's really important for adoptees and former foster youth to understand, especially the intricacies with, you know, the social and economic issues in the United States. But I really, really appreciate you taking the time to speak with me today. Where can people find you, find information about your book tour? Like, where can they connect with you?
Yeah, so I think best social media point of contact at this point for me is Instagram. I'm still on Twitter, but a little bit begrudgingly. So my Instagram is just Gretchen.Sisson. The book has its own website, which is relinquishedbook.com. And there's an events page there. I'm going to be in San Francisco, Boston, DC, Philly, New York, Seattle, Portland, all over the place. I would love to have a really robust audience of adoptees at any and all of the events. You know, I have a number of events where I have adoptees as conversation partners. I'm really looking forward to those conversations. You know, so would love to have people buy the book, request the book from the library, come see me on tour. I think that these are going to be some really good conversations with audiences that really haven't thought deeply about adoption before in some cases. And so would love to see some of your listeners along the way. So thank you
awesome.
So much.
Of course.
I'm so glad that you could join me today. And if you would like to hear more from Adoptee Thoughts, make sure to subscribe and leave a review on your favorite podcast platform. You can find more about me, my books, and more of my work at AdopteeThoughts.com or at Adoptee_Thoughts on Instagram or TikTok.